as I'm sure everyone is very, very keen to hear today from Chris Kent from the RBA. So please join me in welcoming Chris. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Lawrence, and thank you to Kanga News. It's great to be back at this summit. Last year, I discussed the Reserve Bank's move to quantitative tightening, or QT, and today I'm going to provide a brief update on the unwinding of our unconventional policies before I turn to more conventional monetary policy issues, which will be the focus of my presentation. So we're currently pursuing passive QT, whereby we allow our holdings of government bonds to roll off as they mature. The next maturity of substance is the $13 billion worth of the April 2023 Australian government bond. Some central banks have slowed QT by reinvesting some of their maturing bonds. Others have done the opposite, pushing QT along by selling bonds well ahead of maturity. While QT will contribute to a moderate decline in our balance sheet over the next few years, you can see the maturities of those bonds here, the roll-off of the bank's term funding facility will lead to a sizable reduction in our balance sheet this year and next. So banks are preparing for that well in advance, and when the time comes, they'll use some of the balances held in their exchange settlement accounts at the Reserve Bank to repo those loans that they've obtained under the TFF. In return, they'll receive back the collateral that had been provided to secure against those loans. Now, if that collateral was in the form of securities issued by the Australian government or the states and territories, there'll be no net effect on a bank's liquid asset ratio. But much of the collateral pledged for the TFF was in the form of self-securitised assets, which do not count towards a bank's liquidity for regulatory purposes. Accordingly, as they run down their ES balances to repay funds borrowed under the TFF, banks will need to obtain high-quality liquid assets. They could also source, of course, more of their funding in products like term deposits to reduce the amount of liquid assets that they need to hold. Meanwhile, banks have been issuing more long-term bonds in what had, as Lawrence suggested, been relatively favourable conditions in global bond markets. Our liaison with the banks suggests that they are planning for further issuance of bonds as they prepare for the roll-off of the first tranche of $76 billion worth of the TFF between April and September of this year. However, conditions in global bond markets have been strained recently, following the failure, amongst others, of Silicon Valley Bank in the US. Volatility in Australian financial markets has picked up, but markets are still functioning, and most importantly, Australian banks are unquestionably strong. The bank's capital and liquidity positions are well above APRA's regulatory requirements. And the banks are already well advanced on their bond issuance plans for the year. They could defer their bond issuance for a time. And even if markets remain strained for a while, Australian banks' issuance will continue to benefit from the strength of their balance sheets. As loans from the TFF mature and are replaced with funding at higher cost, this will tend to push up banks' funding costs. The TFF accounted for around 5% of banks' overall funding at its peak. However, much of the funding was hedged, either by issuing term-matched fixed-rate mortgages or by using derivatives to convert the fixed-rate TFF payments back to floating rates. Hence, the rise in the cash rate and interest rates more broadly has already had some effect on the cost of banks' funding from the TFF. So now I want to turn to monetary policy of a more traditional nature, inflation targeting. So it was 30 years ago this month when the bank first raised the concept of inflation targeting in a speech by the then Governor Bernie Fraser. His description at that time closely matches the formulation that's used now, namely a flexible medium-term inflation target, whereby the bank aims to keep inflation within the range of 2 to 3% on average over time. Currently, the bank is focused on bringing inflation back down to the target range. High inflation imposes a significant burden on the finances of all Australians. The rise in interest rates, which is needed to rein in inflation, that imposes an extra burden on mortgage holders, but that burden will be higher still if we don't bring inflation down in a timely manner. The transmission of tighter monetary policy through to economic activity and inflation, that takes time. Monetary policy affects spending and business investment, and investment of businesses and households with a lag. And in turn, those changes in demand take time to have their full effect on the setting of prices and of wages. These lags mean that central banks need to set monetary policy with a view to the future, when it will be having its strongest effects. If instead the transmission of monetary policy was rapid, well, in that mythical world, we could use timely course corrections to navigate the economic path. However, the presence of lags in transmission adds a challenge to the setting of monetary policy. The lags in the transmission of policy are not only long, but they're variable. Can change over time in response to cyclical and structural changes in the economy. Further complicating matters, the lags are different across the different channels of monetary policy. So today I'll mention two temporary changes that by themselves are likely to have lengthened the time it currently takes for monetary policy to affect spending via its effect on the cash flow of borrowers. I'll stress at the outset, though, that this cash flow channel is just one way in which monetary policy is transmitted through the economy. There are other critical channels, and as I'm going to emphasise later, these appear to be operating in the usual way. So the first change contributing to slowing the cash flow channel is the high share of fixed rate mortgages by Australian standards. Unlike variable rate borrowers whose required mortgage repayments have risen alongside increases in the cash rate, fixed rate borrowers face a large and delayed jump in their mortgage payments depending on the term of their fixed rate loan. Fixed rate loans, they peak slightly above 35%, as you can see here in this chart, of all housing credit in early 2022. And that compares with a pre-pandemic average of closer to 20%. While fixed rate loans have been rolling off since then, and borrowers have generally switched onto variable rate loans, this adjustment still has some way to play out. So the unusually high share of fixed rate loans when the bank started to tighten monetary policy has added an extra delay to the pass through to outstanding mortgage rates. And we can see the effect of that high share of fixed rate mortgages in this chart. Since last May, the average outstanding mortgage rate across all loans has increased by around 110 basis points less than the cash rate. More than half of this difference owes to the effect of fixed rate mortgages that haven't yet rolled onto higher interest rates. Also, you'll note the average outstanding rate for variable rate mortgages has risen by around 40 basis points less than the cash rate, and that's a result of competition among lenders for good quality borrowers. A few days ago, we published detailed material on fixed rate borrowers. I'm not going to repeat too much of that here, other than to note that increases in the cash rate have been passing through to a sizable number of loans that rolled off their fixed rates last year. So that was about 590,000 loans, or about 10% of the value of all loans. So this has already been occurring. Half of the remaining fixed rate loans are due to roll off over the course of this year. That's about 880,000 loans or so. As those fixed rate loans reset at a higher interest rate, borrowers will be faced with a sizable jump in their required mortgage payments. This reduction in borrowers' free cash flows will place pressure on their budgets. In addition to that, associated with the burden of high inflation, and require an adjustment of their spending and or their savings behaviour. That's not quite the end of the story, though. When we're thinking about the transmission of policy, we need to think about the timing of those cash flow effects on spending of those borrowers. One issue is the extent to which fixed rate borrowers make adjustments in anticipation of rolling over onto a higher mortgage rate to better smooth their spending. Now, if all fixed rate borrowers did this to a significant degree, it would mean that the timing of the cash flow channel would be largely invariant to the share of fixed rate borrowers. But that seems unlikely. I suspect many fixed rate borrowers don't adjust their spending in advance, but rather wait until they roll on to the higher rate. And even those that are more forward looking are likely to make just moderate adjustments at first, with further adjustments required at the time of the switch. Hence, despite the potential for some forward looking behaviour, it's plausible that the high share of fixed rate loans has contributed to a longer lag for the cash flow channel. Estimates of how much further scheduled mortgage payments will rise as fixed rate borrowers roll off their loans this year are provided in this chart. Scheduled mortgage payments, so what are those? Those are interest, the interest payments plus the scheduled principal repayments. Those are shown in the blue bars here, the dark blue bars. And those rose by around 1.1 percentage points of household disposable income over 2022. And then the blue dashed line provides an estimate of how much further scheduled mortgage payments will rise based on the current cash rate. So that's around another 1.5 percentage points further increase by the end of 2024, and most of that comes through by the end of this year. So only about 45% of the rise in the cash rate to date had passed through to total scheduled mortgage payments at the end of last year, though of course slightly more will have passed through in the early months of this year. There's a second important factor that's likely to be adding to the lag in the transmission of monetary policy to household spending: the large run-up in the stock of household savings during the pandemic, with some of that undertaken by borrowers. And we can see that in the sharp rise in what I've labelled here as extra mortgage payments, and those occurred during the pandemic, shown by the violet portion of the bars in this chart. So these are payments into borrowers' offset and redraw accounts. Balances in these accounts are a source of savings that mortgage holders can draw upon if they choose to help sustain their spending in the face of rising interest rates and other cost of living expenses. Even though these extra mortgage payments declined a little through 2022 as scheduled mortgage payments rose, borrowers in aggregate were still adding to this stock of savings. So just taking those violet bars and turning them into a line here in this chart, you can see the stock of the extra payments is high. These are just the flows into. But the stock is high relative to incomes compared with historical experience. This shows the quarterly flows into offset and redraw accounts. Over the decade or so prior to the pandemic, these payments averaged about 2% of households' disposable income. So that's the solid line there, just above 2%. And that reflects the fact that borrowers in Australia, they tend to pay down their mortgages well before the typical contracted term of 25 years. If we focus in on the years between 2012 and 2015, households steadily made above average payments, and so they built additional buffers in their offset and redraw accounts over and above their normal 2%. Interest rates were being cut at the time, and borrowers saved some of the reduction in their scheduled mortgage payments. And then from about 2017 to 2019, when that violet bar drops below the 2% average, borrowers' payments declined quite noticeably. And that occurred at a time of weak income growth. And so reducing their actual mortgage payments in this way helped to sustain stronger consumption than would otherwise have been the case. Now, during the pandemic, borrowers again built up their mortgage buffers at a faster than normal rate. adding a similar additional amount to their buffers as they had done in that earlier episode that I just mentioned. Indeed, for a number of quarters during the pandemic, extra mortgage payments were as much as 2 percentage points above the 2% historical average. And that's all as a share, again, of disposable income on a quarterly basis. Now, extra mortgage payments dipped just below 2% in the December quarter of last year, but the additional mortgage buffer still constitutes an important part of the extra savings of households overall. Now, to give a sense of the size of this additional mortgage buffer that they built up during the pandemic, if borrowers decided not to make any extra mortgage payments for a time, so they just pay what they need to, it would take around 4 quarters for the additional buffer built up during the pandemic to run back down again. Again, this is all relative to historical norms, where Australians pay down their mortgages more quickly than required. Now, indebted households' willingness to draw on these and other savings buffers will have an important bearing on how the economy evolves from here. If borrowers allow these additional savings to run down, even to some extent, it'll help sustain their current spending in an environment of higher interest rates and cost of living pressures. That is, they can choose to delay some or all of the effect of the cash flow channel of monetary policy on their spending for a time. Whether they'll do this, however, is uncertain. They may act like they did in 2017, 2019, running down their buffers by reducing payments into offset and redraw accounts to well below their historical average during a period of weak income growth. Or borrowers may instead decide to hold on to their additional buffers or at least run them down gradually over a much longer period. Indeed, higher interest rates create an incentive to save more and pay down mortgage balances more quickly, and that effect is known as the intertemporal channel of monetary policy. At the same time, there will be some borrowers whose budgets are under substantial pressure, and so they'll have to run down their buffers to meet higher living and interest expenses. Importantly, though, this additional stock of savings that I've been talking about is not distributed evenly across different borrowers. Those with relatively new loans and on lower incomes, they're likely to have more modest buffers, if any, and they'll be feeling more pressure to adjust their spending than others. The bank's very conscious of the challenges facing borrowers, particularly as interest rates have risen very quickly over the past year. That said, a wide range of borrowers appear to have built up sizeable buffers across different income groups and among fixed and variable rate borrowers. This chart just shows for variable rate loans, those borrowers on lower incomes added about $17,000 on average to buffers in offset and redraw accounts over the past 3 years. And this compares with an average of $39,000 accumulated by the highest income borrowers. But loan balances of borrowers on lower incomes, and hence their loan payments, are also smaller on average. They're about $230,000 compared with $575,000 for the high income borrowers. And one final caveat is, even within these income quartiles shown here, the average is skewed by some borrowers accumulating much larger balances than others. So, in summary, the lagged effect of the cash flow channel of monetary policy is likely to be somewhat elongated currently due to the high portion of fixed rate loans and the sizable buffers held by many borrowers. This means it's likely to take longer than usual to see the full effect of higher interest rates on household cash flows and household spending. However, only 1/3 of households have a mortgage, and the cash flow channel is only one way in which higher interest rates affect the economy. Ultimately, what matters for demand and for inflation is how businesses and households overall, not just the borrowers among them, respond to higher interest rates through all of the channels of monetary policy. Now, there's no reason to think that other channels of monetary policy are more or less effective than usual. For example, the sharp reduction in the demand for new housing loans, that's in line with historical experience, given the sharp rise in interest rates and declines in turnover and prices in housing markets. The demand for new construction, that's also fallen noticeably. Higher interest rates are making it more attractive to save, a bit more costly for firms to invest, and they have also contributed to lower asset prices and thereby lower wealth, which will impinge on households' willingness to spend. Now, it may appear as if it may appear that because the Australian dollar has little changed over the past year, at least on a trade-weighted basis, that the exchange rate is not operating as usual. But the rise in interest rates in Australia has helped support the value of the Australian dollar, and therefore the prices of imported goods and services are not as high as they otherwise would have been. In short, all of these other channels of monetary policy are helping to slow the growth of aggregate demand and bring down inflation. The bank will continue to closely monitor the transmission of monetary policy and its impact on household spending, the labour market and inflation. The board will respond as necessary to bring inflation back to target in a reasonable time. And this will benefit all Australians as high inflation imposes a significant burden on all of us, those with a mortgage, those with savings, and the most vulnerable that have neither. And with that, Lawrence, I'm in your hands. Thank you.
Thanks, sir. Thanks very much, Chris. We've got about 10 minutes for questions. A number have come in, but if we can get you a microphone if you want to take the manual approach. Chris, maybe if you see a hand up, you'll let me know. You've got a better view than I have. I'm up there. First
There's
question.
A hand over there, but waving vigorously near the cameras.
Good morning, Chris. Thanks for the speech. My question is about the coordinated action that central banks took over the weekend, given the backdrop of banking crisis we are seeing. Is the RBA involved in conversations with other global central banks in terms of a coordinated action as well? And does that boost the case for a pause in the tightening cycle for the RBA?
Well, we weren't involved in the swap arrangements that have been announced because we don't need to be involved in those. But yes, I am and have been kept informed of these developments over the course of the weekend by my counterparts offshore. As for what all of this implies for interest rates, look, it's just one of many things that the board will be taking into account when it makes its decision next month.
Thanks, Chris. Next question I have here, again, on the situation in the global banking sector. What seems interesting from a policy perspective is that weakness in the global banking sector is being described in terms of a lagging impact of higher rates. Is this the sort of second-order consequence the RBA is considering, and to what extent can systemic risk factor into policy decisions?
Well, I think it's important to sort of put this in some perspective. The banking sector is in much stronger shape globally than it was 10 years or so ago, right? Regulators, markets, banks have made sure they've put a lot more capital in place. There are a lot more stringent requirements around liquidity as well. What we're talking about here is a few institutions that were poorly managed and did not meet those higher standards that have been imposed on almost all banks globally and on Australian banks. So I think that's important to put in perspective. What's happening is leading to questions about some confidence in some banks. All right. Noticeably, it's led to a risk-off move in markets. There's some stresses, extra volatility. And we're seeing some of that here in Australia, but many of the changes that are happening offshore and focused, particularly in the US and in Switzerland as well, many of those changes are much more modest here than they are offshore, as you would expect, given the strength of Australian banks. We have good risk management, good balance sheets here, as I said in my speech. So look, again, the board here we'll be taking account of financial conditions as they do all the time when making their decisions about what to do on monetary policy.
Thanks, Chris. A couple of technicals here on TFF. Would the RBA contemplate a shorter tenor TFF in a future crisis to mitigate the lag associated with fixed rate mortgages?
Well, we haven't done a formal review of the TFF yet, partly because we're still in the midst of it. I wouldn't rule anything out if needed in terms of unconventional policies, but we have learnt quite a lot of lessons from this time around, and I think we certainly wouldn't do things exactly the same as before, and it depends very much on the circumstances, but I don't think that's particularly relevant for where we're sitting today.
Sure, okay. Next one on TFF. Will the RBA cancel the funds received from the TFF repayments, i.e. shrink the money supply it created, or keep the money in a separate RBA account for future use?
No, it's automatic. It just rolls off.
Okay, thanks very much. On lagging effects, given the enhanced risk of over or undershoot in a period in which rate changes come so thick and fast, is the RBA thinking about new or innovative ways to test the impact of policy decisions? In other words, are the data available the best we have, or are there additional tools that could help interpret these lagging effects?
Yeah, look, we're always looking for new and more timely data. I can provide just a few examples of those. I mean, during the pandemic, the ABS very helpfully generated a lot more timely indicators of household spending, and they're particularly useful in things that we focus on, amongst other things. Our liaison, of course, is very extensive. We have offices in every major state capital. They talk to a lot of businesses all the time, and many of those also provide us very helpfully and kindly with data that's particularly useful. We get data from banks, which are processing the data they have in people's accounts in very useful ways. We also, and I showed you, this data on mortgage payments, that wasn't available many years ago. We get timely data on these mortgage payments split into offset and redraw payments across all of the banks with a very short delay. So, yeah, we're always looking at new ways to get a timely read on the economy.
Thanks, Chris. One of my clients wants to ask a question, so I'm going to run across the room.
Hi, Chris. Adam Donaldson from CBA. Just on your speech, it focused a lot on the cash flow channel, as you mentioned, and then noted some of the other channels. A lot of people, when they're doing their assessment of how tight policy is or what a neutral rate is, are doing it through that cash flow lens at the moment. When the RBA is doing it, how are you moderating that view of the world, and I guess what conclusions does it lead you to? Because if it's just cash flow, it looks tight.
Yeah, well, at a high level, when you're trying to forecast the economy and use models to do that, and they're quite fraught, but they're often the best that we have, they tend not to be so sophisticated as to break down all of these different channels and sift through them. They're fairly aggregate. But this sort of analysis that I've presented in my speech says, well, let's just be a bit careful about those. Let's suggest that maybe the effects on spending, for example, might come through a little bit more slowly than otherwise. And then knowing that, let's be vigilant and watch. Watch really carefully. Watch some of these things, these indicators I just told you about. Watch mortgage payments. Watch payments into offset and redraw accounts. Watch consumption indicators, timely things like that. So I think that's how we tend to think about this.
And we'll see if we can get one or two more in. Depends how long the answer is. First one, how does the bank view bank hybrids? Are AT1 non-viability triggers artifacts of documentation, or does AT1 genuinely serve as a loss absorption tool?
Well, that's quite a detailed question and better left for maybe some of the panel that follow me and APRA. But look, they're an important part of the instruments that APRA has asked banks to raise to make sure that they're unquestionably strong. And banks have plenty of those raised, and that's a good thing.
Let's see if we can squeeze one more in, Chris. Sure. There will be a few come through. Do you see a potential scenario where the TFF is extended in the event of sustained volatility in offshore markets?
I think it's a bit too early to be asking that sort of question. As I said, the banks are very well advanced in their plans to pay back the TFF funds, which are coming through this year. They got a lot of paper away earlier in the year. And they're in a very good position to be issuing bonds in markets when those markets calm down a bit. They're not going to want to be, like anyone, the first to go out there in stress conditions. That's normal. That's good management. But as markets eventually get through all of this, calm down a little bit, the Australian banks will be well served by their ability to issue bonds.
Brilliant. Thanks very much. Can everyone please join me in thanking Chris? Thanks for your time.
Thank you. Thank you all.